Okay, structure and content of the Medicare program. I want to talk about eligibility, enrollment, benefits, and coverage. So the Medicare program was created as Title 18 of the Social Security Act back in 1965, and in July of 1966, the program started. And I would say that in October of this year, the Medicare program is a success. I'm frequently criticized by my colleagues and sometimes by participants for telling bad jokes. You notice I told no joke this morning, so there are no jokes. And for my enthusiasm for the Medicare program, for which I will not apologize. I think it's a program that worked. I was a house officer at Boston City Hospital in 1968, and so I know what it was like when the elderly were not covered or when Medicare had just started. And you did not want to be elderly and uninsured. Now you are elderly and insured. And to me, that's an improvement. And I suppose a sign of its success is that people are trying to kill it. But we'll talk a little bit about the program as we go through, and I will try not to show my biases. There are four types of Medicare beneficiaries. There are the elderly, the disabled, and then those with end-stage renal disease, and those with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. There was one person here from the Chronic Disease Center, or Chronic Disease Research Group, which is the group that is related to the USRDS, United States Renal Data System. If you want to study end-stage renal disease, they are really good. They've got a contract with CMS and NIH, and they put out an annual report on kidney disease, end-stage renal disease, and their website, usrds.org, is the place to go. So if you like end-stage renal disease, work with USRDS. But backtracking here to the dominant group or the predominant group in Medicare, the elderly, of which 85% of beneficiaries are elderly, 65 years of age or older. One of the things that the epidemiologists love is that approximately 98% of elderly Americans are Medicare beneficiaries. So the good news is that almost everyone who is elderly is enrolled in Medicare, and we can begin to start thinking about doing population-based studies. However, in about 10 minutes, I'll tell you the bad news, but that's the good news. In addition to the elderly, a major component of the Medicare program are the disabled. I think I heard one, maybe two people interested perhaps in that group, and about 15% of the Medicare beneficiaries are entitled to Medicare because of their disability. Here's a figure that shows the growth of the Medicare program since inception, really. And you can see now that the combined elderly and disabled are approaching 50 million. And in fact, I would think right now as a percentage increase, the disabled are in fact increasing slightly faster than the elderly. So here's the percentage distribution by age in Medicare. Again, numbers I've already showed you. Less than 65 years, about 15 or 16%. Then something that people often forget is that almost half of the elderly are the young elderly. Lots of you love to study post-acute care or the oldest old. Well, I'm not there yet, so I like to study the youngest old. You know, we're pretty good. You know, we're not so bad. And you know, if you have a benefit, you know, you got hopefully 10 or 15 years of good life, whereas in the oldest old, you know, you're really working up against a wall. So I encourage you to study the youngest old as well as the oldest old, where, of course, we tend to spend more resources. Then you can see the other age group, 75 to 84, about 30%, and then 10% are the 85-year-old and older. Gender distribution, more women than men. And here for the distribution by race, one of the things that Beth will talk about in segment D is the race variable. And I won't say too much right now except to point out that the number of Hispanics is increasing, now 7.5%, as well as Asians. Asians alone, about 4%. So blacks make up 10% and whites 77%. Here's the distribution by gender in the two age groups, elderly and disabled. And in the elderly, again, women, the predominant group, but amongst the disabled, men being the dominant group. Pause. Any questions, comments? Pretty basic stuff. Okay, what is this? It is your Medicare card. Well, except none of you has a Medicare card. One Medicare card out there. Okay. I actually became familiar with it when we were doing a study of pneumococcal vaccination in Baltimore County many, many years ago. And so there it is. And what's on it? Tell me about the card. What do you see? And in particular, tell me about this thing right here, the Medicare claim number. Does it look like anything you've seen before? Okay, Social Security number. Is it someone's Social Security number? Does anybody's Social Security number have a letter in it? No. So it's not somebody's Social Security number. But it looks a lot like it, right? Does anyone else want to make a comment? Okay, note, let the video recorder note, no comments. Okay. As a clue or as an answer, this Medicare claim number, also called the health insurance claim number, and again, this issue of things get called different ways by different people, health insurance claim number, or HIC, H-I-C, is actually made up of two components, the CAN and the BIC. Now, the CAN claim account number is actually an SSN. So the first nine digits are the SSN. At the end, there's a two-position field called the BIC, the Beneficiary Identification Code. And it can either be a letter, it can be alpha, or it can be alphanumeric, or just plain numeric. So back to my question, is this an SSN? Yes. Whose SSN is it? Let me say that clearly. Whose SSN is it? Is it the SSN of John D. Doe? That's a pretty dumb question, right? Answer, why not? Well, the real answer is, it may be. Okay? This is the SSN of the person under whom John Doe receives his Social Security benefits. So if John Doe were a stay-at-home dad, okay, and his wife, or if he had a spouse and his wife worked, this SSN would actually be hers, okay, and he would be receiving benefits under her SSN. Now, I know that's not true, because way back when there were no stay-at-home dads, right? But secondly, it ends in an A, and A signifies that this is the beneficiary under whom or for whom benefits are being received, or under whom benefits are being received. If this were Jane Doe, and that she were a spouse of John Doe, and she were receiving benefits under his work history, this would be the same SSN, but it would be a B, okay? And if John Doe died, what happens? You don't know the answer. The B becomes a D, okay? And if Jane Doe marries again, she could have another SSN and another BIC. Now, some of you are taking notes, and the nice thing I can say to you now is don't worry. 20 or 15 years ago and 10 years ago and 5 years ago when we started this workshop, this was a major part of our discussion. The SSN, as I hope I made clear, for any individual can change over time. So like you folks are trying to rationalize claims and information from different data sets, we had a problem within Medicare of rationalizing all the health insurance claim numbers for each person. And that took actually several steps between the researcher and CMS. Now, as I said, you don't have to worry about it. The people at Buccaneer, the CCW, when you get the data, there is a encrypted beneficiary ID. Number one, it is unique to your study, okay? But for each beneficiary, it is constant through all of your data. The question is, if you come back for a second helping, if you're so happy with your data that you'd like more, and you're continuing the same study under the same DUA, the answer to his question is yes. The people at Buccaneer will retain the initial population, and they will know the encrypted IDs for your DUA, and you will get the same encrypted ID on your new data. Any other comments, questions? So I wasn't trying to confuse you in the initial discussion of the Medicare card, but the most important message is not to worry, that you do have this encrypted ID that will be consistent within your data request and in any subsequent data that you get for that DUA. Okay, other things that are on the card real quickly that I might point out are, it does indicate whether the person has hospital insurance or Part A. Again, multiple terms for the same thing. People at CMS sometimes like to call it hospital insurance rather than Part A, and often they like to call Part B supplemental medical insurance. So you'll see HI and SMI. Okay? HI and SMI, Part A, Part B. One thing that's interesting to me is, of course, the card, as far as I know, still doesn't include any information about Part D coverage. And anybody say that I'm wrong on that? Have you seen a more recent card with Part D? No. Okay. Alrighty. This slide just repeats what I said. Here's another one. And then we can go on to talking more about the program. So there are four parts. I already mentioned Part A, or the hospital insurance portion, Part B, or supplemental medical insurance, or SMI. Then there's Part C. I heard maybe four or five times the word Medicare Advantage. That's the most recent incarnation of the what was known as HMOs, or managed care. Okay, it's now called Medicare Advantage. So if you want to be modern, Part C is called, again, Medicare Advantage. And in order to be enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan, you must have both Part A and Part B coverage. Part D is the prescription drug program, which began in 2006. And I will say a few words about that. But first, Medicare Part A and its benefits. The one that most of you will look at is hospital care. I heard the word MedPAR again several times, so I know many of you are working on hospitalizations. The mention of rehospitalizations was out there also. Part A also covers skilled nursing facility or SNF care, home health agency care, and hospice care. If you're receiving home health care, it's skilled care, and it is supposed to be rehabilitative care, and presumably the patient is confined to home, but I think that requirement is relaxed, although the Inspector General is here to tell us if that's true or not. Eligibility for Part A, first of all, going to the elderly, a person is eligible if they or their spouse worked 40 or more quarters in their lifetime and paid the Medicare tax while working. How many of you were told by your mother, dad, aunt, or someone, work your 40 quarters? Yeah. For about the last 10 years, nobody is being told that. When I graduated high school, that was one of the first things I was told. You know, get your draft card, and then B, make sure you work for 40 quarters. Why would people say that? Medicare wasn't in existence. I should tell you, when I graduated from high school in 1960, Medicare didn't exist. So why would someone like my mother say, work your 40 quarters? Right. If you pay, I'm sorry, Social Security. Yes. If you work for 40 quarters and you and your employer pay the Social Security tax, then you will receive Social Security benefits. So for people of my age and those who are currently in the Medicare program, working the 40 quarters was almost a no-brainer. Okay? Most of us had jobs, and most of those jobs did pay into Social Security. And then when the Medicare program came along, then with the Medicare tax, you have the same requirement of the 40 quarters that make you automatically eligible for Medicare. Now, as it says up here on the slide, for those who do not work the full 40 quarters, you can actually buy into the program. The premium, you know, you can judge whether it's high or low, but it's $450, $51 a month if you want to buy into Medicare Part A this year. As I said earlier, 98% of the people over 64 are enrolled in Part A. Then the disabled, who I mentioned earlier, are also eligible for Medicare after they have been receiving SSDI, or Social Security Disability Insurance, benefits for 24 months. End-stage renal disease, as soon as you get the disease or are documented with the disease, and ALS will make you Medicare eligible. Okay, Part A deductibles and coinsurance. Both Medicare Part A, now that I'll talk about, and in a few minutes Part B, have deductibles and coinsurance. Deductible for Part A for hospitalization has always been 1 day of hospitalization. So you pay for the first day, now estimated to be $1,156. And then after that first day, Medicare will cover all of your hospitalization until day 61. And then, as you can see up on the slide, you have to pay one quarter of the deductible, and then after 90 days, up to 150 days, half of the deductible, and then you pay all costs after 150 days. And for SNF care, after the 20th day, so days 1 through 20 are essentially free, paid for by Medicare. After day, starting on day 21, then you pay a coinsurance of $144. Anybody figure out real quickly where the $144 comes from? Any math whizzes out there? It's 1/8 of 1156. Okay, so you're paying 12.5% of the 1 day stay in a hospital as your coinsurance for SNF care. One thing to note, though, there's no cost sharing for either home health or hospice. The last time I gave this talk, someone reminded me, and actually I didn't even know the difference, what's the difference between copay and coinsurance? A little quiz. Are they interchangeable words? What's the difference between copayment and coinsurance? Yes, the answer from the audience is a copay is a fixed amount and coinsurance is a percentage. To me, when I looked that up and I reaffirmed it last night, you know, before I started talking today, seems a bit of minutia, okay? But if you pay a $15 payment when you see your primary care physician, that's a copayment because it's $15. If you pay 20% of your prescription drug, that's coinsurance, okay? So for the people who like to worry about words, a little bit of extra knowledge. How many knew that already? Let the record show 3 people. Oh, 4, sorry, 4 people. Even Phyllis knew it from last April. Okay, payment of Part A bills. The providers, and we often call them institutional providers as distinguished from non-institutional providers. I don't know if that helps you or not. I mean, buildings are institutions, hospitals are institutions, okay? So providers of Part A services use the UB04, which is also called the CMS 1450 form. Uniform bill is what UB stands for. But again, this is the form they use. And all claims for Part A services, period. Let me show you the form quickly. Here it is. There's one in your notebook. Pretty boring, and we won't go any more into it. But again, the Part A providers will submit this form, and what they do is they submit it to somebody who pays them the money. Okay? The claims don't go directly to CMS, and Barb will describe that whole process. And in the past, the Part A claims used to go to something called fiscal intermediaries, and they were the old Blue Cross plans, basically, when Medicare started. And there was a fiscal intermediary, or FI, in each state. So there were 50. Now, Medicare has changed, and there's something called MACs. And if you did the homework assignment before coming, you began to see that there are no longer 50 MACs, and that some of the MACs have several states within their network. And so, again, these claims are sent to the Medicare Administrative Contractors, or MACs. Then the last point is that the Part A services are paid for out of the Medicare Trust Fund. And we'll talk more about that in a very apolitical way in about 10 minutes. But how do we build the Medicare Trust Fund? What creates that trust fund? No answers. Oh, you know, it's the Medicare tax, right? You and your employer pay a tax on all of your wages, and that goes, and that's what builds the Medicare tax, the Medicare Trust Fund, sorry. In preparing and reading last night, I noticed that in the Affordable Care Act, there's going to be a new tax that will then help fund the trust fund. So any dividend income or unearned income in people making $200,000 or couples making more than $250,000 will have a 3.8% additional tax that will go into the Medicare trust fund. Okay? So for those of you on the right side of the political spectrum, that's a no-no. That's a bad thing. But anyway, it's a way that the Affordable Care Act is trying to increase the Medicare Trust Fund. There's that form. And then we can move on to Part B or SMI benefits. Okay, the major part of Part B are physician services. Although, remember, there are other kinds of health providers besides physicians. I know it hurts the doctors when we say that, but, you know, other people do good things for Medicare beneficiaries, and so Medicare needs to pay them, and those are generally Part B services. One thing, though, that you need to remember is in these next two bullet points. The facility charges for a hospital outpatient service and also ambulatory care, surgery centers, and things like that are Part B services. Okay? They're Part B services, but because the particularly the outpatient hospital is an institution or dealt with as an institution, they will actually use the Part A form, okay, the UBO form, to submit their claim for a Part B service. I know it's a little confusing the first time. So person goes to a hospital outpatient. They receive a Part B service. The hospital, the institution, when billing for that service, their part of that service, will put it on the same form they use when they bill for Part A services. Meantime, the physician or other provider who is also part of that outpatient visit will submit a claim, and I'll show you in a minute, this the CMS 1500 form, and that will go into a different file. We'll talk about it, the carrier file. So people with hospital outpatient visits will have two claims, and each of those claims will appear in two different files. And tomorrow we'll talk about how you work to make sure you don't double count, for example, or which might be the more efficient way to find cases or procedures when you have this situation. So let me just read this so it perhaps is clearer than I was just saying. A person who is seen in a hospital or hospital outpatient setting will generally generate two claims, one from the facility and one from the physician. Now, reading that reminds me what I should have said perhaps initially, that if you're hospitalized, I don't want to say of course, but you will have a hospital claim, and then the attending physician, the consulting physicians will also submit claims, and they will be, again, coming in on the CMS 1500 form into the carrier file. So when you're trying to look at costs of care in a hospital, you need to, again, consider more than one data file. Finally, Part B services are also there to cover any durable medical equipment. Now, Part B enrollment isn't quite as easy as Part A entitlement. Somebody or someone or some agency or yourself have to pay in order to be enrolled in Part B. And for most people, there is a deduction of the premium payment made in the monthly Social Security check. And then I've got some numbers here just to show, if you track through there, how the Part B premiums have, in fact, increased, in my mind, quite a bit over the last decade. So here in 2000, $45. Now the minimum payment is almost $100. As it says here, you don't have to enroll in Part B when you first are eligible for Medicare, but then if you don't enroll at that initial time, you have to pay a premium later on, an additional premium. And one other thing to note is that the payment range in 2012 is between $99 or $100, basically, and around $319. I think all of you found that in your assignment. Further, interestingly, that premium is actually less in 2012 than 2011. Okay, in addition, there are deductibles and coinsurance, so that the deductible has been increasing also. It's now $140 in 2012, and then there's coinsurance of 20% for all of the Part B payments. There are some exceptions, though. For laboratory tests, there's no coinsurance for influenza and pneumonia vaccination, as well as PSA screening, prostate-specific antigen. There's no coinsurance, and it doesn't count, or you don't need to have met your deductible to have Medicare pay for it. And then finally, one of the great things of 2010, just after Ted Kennedy died, was finally the passage of the Mental Health Parity Act. For those of you who are concerned about mental health and mental health services, there's been a bias since forever that people who require mental health services should have a coinsurance of 50%, whereas if you have physical illness, the coinsurance tends to be, and in Medicare is, just 20%. But with the Parity Act passed in 2010, beginning in 2011, this 50% coinsurance will gradually decrease over, I believe it's 5 years, down to 20%. So parity with physical illness. Okay. Now this top bullet states the basic that the physicians and other providers, including those who provide durable medical equipment, use the CMS Form 1500 and submit their claims to the same Medicare administrative contractor for their geographic area. And then this repeats what I said earlier. Let me read it, because if I try to say it, I get all confused. So, hospital outpatient facilities and home health agencies use the UB04 form to submit claims for Part B services. Okay, so the first thing that's maybe a little bit of a disconnect there is just remember that hospital outpatients and home health provide both Part A and Part B services. Okay, so when they are providing a Part B service, they still use that form they use when they provide Part A services. Okay? And these forms used to be submitted to the fiscal intermediary. Now, with the MACs that process both the Part A and Part B claim, the hospital outpatient and the home health agency send their Part A and their Part B claims to the same organization. So that makes it sound a little simpler, but again, the organization is receiving things on two different forms, and ultimately that information winds up in different files, okay? At least for the hospital outpatient. For the home health agency, it all appears in the home health agency file. Okay, here's the Part B form, or the CMS 1500, and we'll talk about that in great detail tomorrow. Now, here's a slide I'd like to pause on for a second. So let me just ask, are there any questions about Part A, entitlement, services, payment? Okay, a good part of it you'll hear again later today and tomorrow. If you look at this slide, and I think you can see it pretty well in your notebook, these are the revenue sources for Medicare in fiscal year 2009, probably not too different than currently 2011, 2012. And so you can see, first of all, that all of Medicare is costing $500 billion, so half a trillion and change. Now, look at Part A. Okay, so half of all roughly is Part A, so hospitals still get the lion's share. Part B is incredibly large. It used to be maybe a 65-35 split between A and B, but Part B services, at least in terms of total cost, have increased quite a bit. And then you've got Part D, which is about 12% of the total at $60 billion. But what to me is interesting and I think worth pausing as a little bit of a civics lesson on more than something to do with the actual data is to see what the different revenue sources are. So I went quickly when I talked about Part B and just said, where does the trust fund get its money? And that's from payroll taxes. 85% comes from payroll taxes. There's smaller amounts. 6% comes from taxation of Social Security benefits, which I don't quite understand, and then others. So mostly, again, from payroll taxes. What about these other two? Where does most of the money come from for Part B, which we're talking about right now, and then Part D that we'll talk about in a little while? It comes from the general fund. Who is the general fund? Anybody? That's you and me, right? It's the general fund, the revenue raised every year for the federal government. So, first of all, note that Part B, and this is actually required by law, that the Part B costs are covered 75% by the general fund and 25% by the beneficiaries. And so that's why you see adjustments in the Part B premium year to year, is to try to, first of all, figure out how much it's going to cost, and then to try to estimate that 25%. So here, the beneficiaries, if you will, they've paid most of this, but they haven't paid most of this. Okay? And that's a question of redistribution, social justice, whatever you want to talk about. But that's what it is. And the thing that the reason I bring it up, and I don't get too excited because it is just facts, is that when people talk about Medicare going broke, what they are talking about, I believe, but they never make the distinction, is Part A, because that's the trust fund that's going broke. The general fund will never go broke. And so when people talk about Medicare going broke, they're not talking about Part B, they're talking about Part A. Now, Part D, well, I've got it up here, why don't I just finish? Notice for Part D, 80% comes out of the general revenue. Okay, so have the beneficiaries paid for their Part D services? Well, they only pay 9% through their premiums, okay? Think about it. So when people criticize the Part D program as being a burden on the taxpayer, and some people do, it's because it is funded out of the general fund and not by the people who consume the service, okay? And I just say that as a neutral statement. Again, it is a redistribution of income from those of us who are paying taxes to the people who have the Part D program. Managed care, later called Medicare Plus Choice, now called, what did I say it was called before? Right, Medicare Advantage. Okay. So we've had fee-for-service Medicare since 1966. Medicare managed care began in 1985. And as I said earlier, you must have both Part A and Part B and continue to pay the Part B premium or have it paid for you in order to be in Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage, briefly described, the MA plan assumes the risk. The plan is paid by CMS on a capitated basis. The capitation is based on something called the CMS Hierarchical Condition Codes, or CMS HCC. I don't have time to go into the detail of that, but that's fun reading and understanding that. Initially, the capitation was based on 95% of the average annual per capita cost. And what that means is that if you lived in a certain county and were in Medicare Advantage, CMS paid the Medicare Advantage provider 95% of what it costs for the average beneficiary living in that county, adjusting for a couple of things. That was cool. Except, and it also made sense, right? Because you were doing managed care, right? If you have managed care, it should cost less. Made sense. However, in previous recent administrations, the managed care plans weren't making enough money. And so they've changed it so that now the Medicare Advantage plans are basically paid 10, 14% more than the cost of treating a fee-for-service patient. Now, that is a political statement on my part. I mean, that's a real change. And there are a couple of people from Kaiser. Do you want to? Well, you're special. You know, and Kaiser is special. But the other Medicare Advantage plans are making now more money on every beneficiary than those people, than it costs to treat someone in the fee-for-service system. End of statement. Okay. However, or maybe because of that, managed care or Medicare Advantage has continued to grow, particularly once this change took place here in the mid portion of the first decade of the 21st century. And so here we go. We've got almost 30% now, over 25% of Medicare beneficiaries are in Medicare Advantage. Okay. So what they notice is, first of all, they're getting more services, 10% more, 14% more. Plus, with the advent of Part D, a lot of people found that the Medicare Advantage drug programs being linked to the Medicare Advantage plans was something that was attractive to them. And so you have, particularly after 2006, this marked increase in beneficiaries joining Medicare Advantage, and I think it's been stimulated by the MAPD or Medicare Advantage prescription drug programs. Now, earlier I said the good news for the epidemiologist was that 98% of all elderly beneficiaries or all elderly Americans are Medicare beneficiaries. The bad news is that over 25% are in Medicare Advantage because we do not get claims data for these people. So the question of generalizability, although no one raises it at the end of their papers, you know, it doesn't say Medicare study, blah, 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 weakness, only represents 75% of the elderly. But I think you need to know that. Again, somebody someday will start seeing whether there are major differences caused by that leakage, if you will, in terms of what we can say in terms of the entire elderly population. Here we have a couple of other points to make in terms of Medicare Advantage as it's distributed throughout the country. If you can see it perhaps better at the table than on the screen, there's a wide range in Medicare Advantage enrollment by state. The West Coast, which is, you can see a little darker here, Minnesota, Florida, a few other areas, Pennsylvania, very high enrollment, other states as low as 4%. In Wyoming, 3% in Vermont. This is 2009. Here's similar for 2011. I couldn't find one that had the actual state percentages, but roughly the same distribution. And here's one we did way back when in 2001. Looks the same, okay? So in one sense, if you've got a problem, you've had it for a long time, so don't worry about it. There's variation at the state level. However, one thing to point out is looking at the county level, so that some of you will go home and you'll do more local studies than I do. I tend to do national studies. And if you're in Florida or California along the West Coast, you can see that even by county, there's huge variation in HMO penetration. So I just point this out to remind you that if one of these areas so where there's high and low, a mixture of high and low HMO penetration, you might want to take that into consideration in your study. So in summary, what I've said in the last couple of minutes, there's been an increase in the rate of enrollment in managed care or Medicare Advantage, and I have answered my question why I think that's due to Part D. The enrollment is not uniformly distributed throughout the country, and as I said a few minutes ago, these data, called encounter data, are not available for researchers. We keep hearing it will be available. CMS has data that they could make available, but it is not yet available. I keep putting this next bullet point in here. back in 1999, we were saying, well, by the 1st of January in 2000, we'll have hospital data. Ha. Has never happened, and it's 12 years later. The good news is that Beth will describe in segment D how you can identify those people in Medicare Advantage and then how you can exclude them. So you can toss them out of your denominator. They're not in your numerator, so you can get rid of them from your denominator, and that we recommend these exclusions be made. Okay, end of part C or Medicare Advantage. Any questions? Okay, so this is a bit of a transition, or at least a transition I can make into part D, because even though I just said you can't get information on part A and part B services provided to Medicare Advantage beneficiaries, you do know, or you can get information on beneficiaries who are enrolled in the Medicare Advantage prescription drug plans. So you can do comparisons, if that's your interest, in Medicare Advantage MAPD and fee-for-service drug beneficiaries, PDP plan users. So that is possible. Okay, so the Medicare prescription drug program, or Medicare Part D. Here are some acronyms that you may not have come across in the past, so let me run through them very quickly. PDP is the prescription drug plan related to fee-for-service beneficiaries. MAPD, as I've said many times, is the Medicare Advantage variety. Prescription drug event, we talk about events. We don't talk about claims. And it's about a 10-minute discussion, but you'll see in the Medicare Part D data, a 10-minute discussion that I don't have time for, you'll see events, you'll see the PDE files, prescription drug event file, as opposed to claim file. Initial coverage limit, or ICL, I'll talk about that more in a minute. Then there's the catastrophic coverage limit, something called TROOP, true out-of-pocket cost, low-income subsidy, the master beneficiary summary file I've already mentioned, and the BSF, the beneficiary summary file. So Medicare Part D, implemented in 2006 as part of the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003. It's a based on a competitive model, which, as it says here, beneficiaries can voluntarily purchase drug coverage offered by private drug plans, not public drug plans. The Part D plans have a lot of flexibility in designing the plan, the benefit package, so there could be different deductibles or no deductibles, different copays, certainly different formularies, things that are used to encourage efficient use of drugs like prior authorization can vary between plans, and premiums vary by plans. So when we do our workshop, and if you're interested in Part D, I encourage you to come to CMS 106, our workshop related to Medicare Part D. We do an exercise like the one you did before coming here, where we ask people to take me, basically, and find a plan for me. It's kind of fun. I mean, if you want to start learning about the program, just, you know, call your aunt or your mom or dad or someone and say, what drugs are you on? And then see if you could find a good plan for them. It's a way to begin to understand the Part D program. And you can find that on the Medicare website. Part D enrollment is by calendar year. You can choose, again, from a multiple number of plans, as it says in the next bullet. In 2012, every beneficiary had at least 25 plans from which to choose. Open enrollment last year was beginning on October 15th. It will be the same this year, and it will run through December 7th. Interesting to note, though, only about 6% of people switch plan year to year. So once in a plan, people seem to be pretty stable. The fourth bullet here points out that the premium actually went down in 2012 from 2011. That's an encouraging sign, perhaps. The percentage of Medicare beneficiaries enrolled in Part D, though, isn't the 98% or the 75% that we've been talking about in Part A or fee-for-service compared to Medicare Advantage. Only about 60% of people are enrolled in Part D. And as I've said, Part D is optional. Enrollment is optional, as with Part B, but also if you join later, there is a penalty for not joining at age 65. One of the things I'll talk about a little bit in a few minutes is this extra help for this thing called low-income subsidy, the LIS. Okay, so here's Part D enrollment in 2010. The first thing to think about is whether a person has creditable coverage. So 32-33% of the people have some kind of drug coverage that's deemed to be equivalent to the Medicare Part D. So if you're a retired federal employee, if you're retired from an industry that had perhaps a strong labor union, you have a drug benefit as part of your retirement benefits, and that's considered creditable coverage. So if you're in that category and don't join Medicare Part D, you don't have to pay a premium on your premium. Sorry for saying it that way, but you don't have to pay an extra premium if you ever do join Part D. Period. Then there are people who don't have any creditable coverage. So these people don't have any drug coverage as far as we know. Then for those who do have Part D, you see the distribution roughly two-thirds, one-third, not quite, but close enough, between the fee-for-service or PDP drug plans and the MAPD drug plans. This is an attempt to show the benefit. If you start at the bottom, as a person begins to consume drugs and have them paid for, most the standard benefit, again, this is standard benefit, and there are lots of plans, particularly the MAPDs, that have no deductible. But again, standard benefit, there is a deductible phase. Then after a certain point, you go into essentially the insurance phase, where the beneficiary is paying 25% and the insurer is paying 75%. Then you reach this line here, which is the initial coverage limit. And then you fall into the donut hole. The more formal term is coverage gap. So again, repeating, you have a deductible you've got to meet, then you have insurance and co-insurance or co-payment. Here it's a percentage, so co-insurance, but they are more likely co-payments. And you reach this initial coverage limit, you fall into the donut hole. And the new news in 2012 was that in prior years, this coverage gap period, the beneficiary had to pay the whole amount, whereas in 2012, for brand name drugs, the beneficiary only paid 50% and had a 14% reduction in generic drugs. And of course, these two numbers will increase over time until they become zero. That's all part of the Affordable Care Act. Once you reach this next threshold, which is called the catastrophic threshold, then the enrollee pays a very, very tiny amount in terms of a copay. The plans are pretty much off the hook, and Medicare pays 80%. So in this catastrophic phase, Medicare is paying the bill. So it goes beneficiary, insurer, beneficiary, Medicare. Comments, questions? There are a couple of things on the side here. Here's this acronym TROOP, True Out-of-Pocket Payments. And over here is the actual drug cost. So the reason I feel compelled to put the TROOP amount in here is this is the actual dollar amount that are used to calculate these various cut points and are used by the chronic condition warehouse if you ever start getting a Part D data to describe where people are either just here or here and here, 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 and here, et cetera. But this is just to make it a little bit more realistic. This is the actual amount as it would be translated into the actual drug payment. So above about $3,000, you fall into the donut hole. And then finally, $3,700 later, you're in this catastrophic phase. I put here the definition of TROOP because it is so complicated, or so long, I guess, not complicated. But when people talk about, or Medicare talks about, true out-of-pocket costs, this is both out-of-pocket spending, and it's very fun because it says of the beneficiary or family member or official charity, supplemental drug coverage through a state pharmacy assistance program like the PACE program in Pennsylvania, or the low-income subsidy, the LIS I've mentioned a couple of times, or under demos. So there's a whole lot of stuff here that it isn't just what the person actually pays, but what they pay plus what a lot of their friends can help them pay. And then, as I said a couple of minutes ago, the troop is important because that's what CCW uses in calculating where someone is along this spectrum of Part D payment. Here are some data now, and there'll be a few slides like this showing how things have changed over time. Things have gotten a bit more expensive under Part D for the past 7, 2, 4, 6 years. You can see the deductible has gone up, as has the ICL, the troop, and the total drug coverage or expenditure, total drug expenditure coverage. So things are getting more expensive. Here's that slide I showed earlier, and again to remind you that most of the payment for Part D comes out of the general fund or the general revenue. This extra help I mentioned, low-income subsidy, there is this program to help beneficiaries pay for their deductible, their coinsurance, and possibly co-payments, depending on what their income level is. People who have low-income subsidy or who qualify for the low-income subsidy have no liability in the coverage gap, and there's no late enrollment penalty. Over the last couple of years, if you can imagine, there is this benefit, and people at CMS and a number of advocacy groups are concerned that the beneficiaries who are eligible for the subsidy actually get it. And so there have been a lot of efforts to encourage people to know about this subsidy and to sign up for it. Here is the Medicare Part D enrollment. Again, slightly different pie chart where I've included now the LIS people, and I'll go through this kind of close slowly. So here's the 10% with no creditable coverage. Then here, 14 plus 13 plus 3, these are the people with creditable coverage, but broken down into groups like the federal employee workers, retired beneficiaries, people who have TRICARE, or active workers like me. Then there's other types of creditable coverage. Okay, so here's primary coverage through retirement plans, this group, 14. Then others, there are employers who actually get something called a retiree drug subsidy, which means that CMS was trying to encourage people who had drug coverage from their labor union or from their employer to continue having that coverage rather than falling completely into Medicare Part D. So Medicare will pay part of that drug plan for those people, and then here others with creditable coverage. So that's the creditable coverage group. And then here are the MAPD people, the 21%, and 4% of those, so about 25% of the MAPD people, are LIS, which tend to be lower income people. The PDP folks, though, that 38%, almost half, okay, are LIS. And so, again, as we begin to think about generalizability, if we have Part A and Part B data only on those who are in PDP, and half of those people who are in PDP are in LIS, then the people on whom you really have a lot of data, A, B, and D, half of them are poor. So again, you have to start worrying about the generalizability of what you're doing. This is more about the low-income subsidy, and here are a couple of slides that show the details. I won't go into them now, more than you need to know. Bingo. Just a couple of comments on the Part D data itself. I've broken it down into denominator data, if you will, and numerator data. The denominator data is in the beneficiary summary file segment of this master beneficiary summary file I've mentioned several times that Beth will talk about. And the information in this beneficiary summary file segment is there for all Medicare beneficiaries. And so whether or not you're in Part D, you still will know, obviously, whether they're in Part D or not, whether they're in a PDP or MAPD, and you'll also know the LIS status. So it gives you some clues for beneficiaries as to their income, and then you also can know about their dual eligible status. More about this later. Finally, the numerator data in Part D is in something called the prescription drug event records, or PDE file, and a couple of facts about this PDE file. There are about 1 billion claims in it annually. This, again, is the name of the file. And it's linkable to something called characteristics files, which contains information about the medication. So you can know whether it's a generic drug, a brand drug. You can know how many days prescription they received. You can also know about the drug plan. You can know some things about the prescriber, the physician, as well as the provider, the pharmacy, although this information is quite limited. And again, if you're interested in Part D, we encourage you to come to our Part D workshop. So if you haven't understood things I've said, there's help out there called the Research Data Assistance Center. Again, most of you, or all of you, know about us. Some of you have actually used the assistance desk. Briefly to describe it, we've had a contract now for 17 years with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to provide services and to help CMS increase the number of researchers' skills in accessing and using CMS databases for studies of the Medicare and Medicaid programs and beneficiaries, and I like to add, in order to improve the health of these beneficiaries. We have the assistance desk, which is staffed by master's level trained technical advisors, and they're happy to answer any of your questions regarding Medicare and Medicaid, the data access and availability, record layouts, information about the program. So if you have any questions, please feel free to contact the assistance desk, and we will work with you from your first inquiry until you actually submit a complete data request to CMS. The technical assistance desk supports the ResStack website, and our website was revitalized and modernized in August, so if you haven't visited it since then, you might want to do that. Here are the workshops. You are currently in CMS 101, as you know. I mentioned earlier CMS 102, Introduction to the Use of Medicaid Data for Research. And then we have a few other specialty workshops. There's one on cost reports, for those of you who are interested in that, our Part D workshop. And we have been running one on comparative effectiveness research, which we may or may not continue. Here's the way to contact ResDAC. Again, most of you know these, but they're there for your reference.